You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.
Hi, I'm Kennedy Weibel, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show. Yeah.
All right. You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Kennedy Weibel. He's the author of Dirty Myrtle. Kennedy, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. Did you notice that when I was reading your title, I had a pause because I had to make sure I got Myrtle right, even though I know Myrtle, like when you see Myrtle Beach, like M-Y-R-T-L-E, it's automatic. But to see the word alone, especially from a fella on the West Coast, I'm like, my retle. Not to diss on your title, man. It's a great title. It's like a drink, you know?
Thank you. I have heard it so much. I grew up there, and it was always the sort of, I like to think affectionate, nickname for the town.
So locally it's referred to that?
Probably a little bit less so now, but when I was growing up, there were strip clubs were a lot more prominent on like major roads, like just mixed in with the other tourist attractions. And I think that's a little bit of where the name came from, you know, our visitors going down to Old Dirty Myrtle, up and down the East Coast. When I meet people and tell them where I'm from, that's what I hear.
So you are from Myrtle. You're from Myrtle Beach, but now you live in Raleigh.
That's right.
Wow.
Born and raised Myrtle Beach.
Now, is that a spring break destination? Isn't that what that is?
Oh, big time. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Spring break, summer break, there's bike weekends, and the weather's pretty nice year round. So in the winter, we get a bunch of golfers, lots of golf courses. It goes down a little bit in the winter, but it's pretty much a full-time vacation spot along the East Coast.
So you grew up a townie.
Yeah. If you ever go on vacation there and you're like, you know, you go to a restaurant, you're like, who are these people who live here and wait tables here? That was me.
Wow.
That was me bringing your plate for the buffet, clearing your dishes, serving crab legs.
Is there like
working
when
at your water parks?
Oh my God. Exactly. There's gotta be some disdain from the locals when it's just constantly flooded with tourists. I'm just saying that. I don't know, because I never had boots on the ground there. Maybe it's fantastic, but.
I think it's the weird dichotomy of anybody who grows up in or lives in a tourist town is you need them. They bring in the money. That's where your revenue comes from. But the traffic stinks and they're everywhere. And, you know, you can't get into places, you can't get around, and you sort of hate them at the same time, but they need to be there.
Yeah. And you
and
all
are kind of stuck with this mentality.
Do you have like a local like vibe where when you walk up to a bar, they're just like, oh, hey, Kenny, you know, like you can get through to a lot. You have access to a lot of places where the tourists are going, wait, how did he get in? And it's just like, no. He's from here. So back off. Is there that vibe too?
There's very much that vibe. And when you grow up there, you tend to know a lot of people who work at all these places. Like these are your jobs. My wife and I were talking one time and she kind of made fun of me. She was talking about working at Wendy's when she was younger. And I was asking questions about it. She's like, you never worked in fast food? I was like, I grew up in a tourist town. It just wasn't like kid jobs were busboy and dishwasher and host. And you worked up to barback and bartender and waiter. And you worked in water parks. I cleaned pools. You work on golf courses. People obviously work in fast food restaurants, but there's this variety of kid jobs that you maybe don't get in, you know, upstate New York.
Yeah. So you've done a lot of restaurant work. Yeah.
Yeah. I spent a lot of time in the kitchen.
Yeah. Oh, okay. You were in the kitchen. See, I was front of house a lot when I was younger, and it made me have a huge disdain for humanity in general. I had to stop because I'm just like, this is, I'm like, I despise everybody walking in now because I just have no more tolerance. I'm done. And that was
so
after
I got
about
around the
5 years.
restaurant. I've done I've done busboy, I've done barback, I've washed
Yeah.
dishes, I've been a host, I've been a food runner, I've been a waiter. There is no one on earth doing their job as well as someone sitting down at a table in a restaurant expects that waiter to do
Right,
their
right.
job.
Yeah.
No one
Especially
is
in a
achieving
tourist.
this level of perfection. Oh, especially, yeah. Because
Yeah.
everything's a little more expensive. They're eating out more often. They're like
Right.
having fun, but they're slightly resentful of the third time they have to go out to eat while they're on vacation. They're paying for it. But yeah, the
Yeah.
expectations are through the roof. They'll complain about anything. It really, I think you said it really well. It lowers your appreciation for like the decency of humanity.
Yeah, and I didn't even think about this because not only do like especially a family puts like kind of high pressure on, oh, we're going out, so this better be fun. And then but if they're
Yes.
going on vacation, then it's like, oh my God, I've been working my butt off for like the last, 50 weeks. Now I finally get to hang out with my family and we need this time to be great. And so that pressure
Yes.
goes on to like the entire city of Myrtle Beach. That's like
Yeah.
weird
Yeah. The
energy.
expectations are very high.
Yeah.
There is something interesting. So you worked front of house, like you were like a
Yeah.
waiter, you were in
I
the.
w I was I was I was bus I've been dishwasher, busboy, waiter, I was room service for a while, yeah.
Do you remember smoking sections in restaurants?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
We used to fight over the smoking section because you always got better tips in the smoking section because the smokers also drank. The bill was higher, they
Oh.
were in a little bit better mood.
Yeah.
And we used to, I remember arguing over the smoking section, and I bring it up now, and people are like, you could smoke. Like, didn't everyone in the restaurant smell the smoke? And like, oh yeah, 100%.
Yeah,
But
except they were sat over there. Don't you
yeah,
get
it was this imaginary partition that like just the left side smokes and the right side gets the pleasure of not having it directly at their table, I guess.
Right. Oh man. Oh, do you remember? Okay, I'm gonna throw a term out here and you may get it instantly. Capping ashtrays.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's like something
Do the
nobody
little
knows.
cover move so that the ashes don't blow everywhere when you pick
Yeah,
it up and swap it out.
walk up when you switch out ashtrays, you got to go with two ashtrays because one goes on top of the ashtray and then you put the new ashtray down. So you're not walking around with ash all over a cloud of ash.
That's deep, like proving your bona fides knowledge when you remember capping ashtrays.
Cap
You have
and
to carry the second
ashtrays.
one out
That
there.
yeah, that's just like that is such like an era that stopped probably sometime in the 90s, maybe. Or I don't know. I'm in
Yes.
California, so they might have been way stricter on it here, where they started cutting the laws.
You guys got it first. I remember going to
Yeah.
California in the mid 90s, and I was surprised you couldn't smoke inside. It was the first place I'd ever been in my life where you couldn't smoke indoors.
Yeah.
And then
Taking our
I think it was
freedoms,
the early,
man. Taking our
yeah,
freedoms.
it was the early 2000s. I remember it hit New York, and
Yeah.
that was, I feel like, a tipping point. Like, as goes New York, so goes the rest of the country.
Oh
But
yeah.
I think there might be bars in South Carolina and Myrtle Beach where you can smoke inside now,
See, well,
like
it does
today.
like there when I the last place because I'm from San Francisco, so I moved to Los Angeles about 12 years ago, but the last apartment I had was in a place called the Tenderloin, which is kind of notorious for
Yeah.
it's just like if you want crack and maybe to get shot, you go to the Tenderloin. It's always it's like oh, the one danger zone of San Francisco. So I lived in it. But we had this great bar about two blocks away from me called the Geary Club. And they like allowed smoking deep and until about 2012. And it was one of the last true dive bars where it's just like the beauty about San Francisco dive bars is like everyone from all walks of life would come in. So you'd have that guy that
Yeah.
was day drinking, and then you have a guy that's has it's everyone from the neighborhood, so it's just now when I go up there, maybe because I'm the tourist, I'm like I walk in and but they've poshed everything up. There's no it's like it's almost like there's no more dive bars, and if you do go into
No,
the
I see
dive
it.
bar, go ahead.
I see it all over. I go to the, like, there's a look that I. These bars open and they open immediately with a look as though the style was picked out of a catalog. And somebody
Yes.
was sort of like, I want tile, I want this, I want that. It has a very like Albon Payne or Panera Bread kind of feel to it. Like it feels
Yes.
pre-selected to look very sleek and elegant and shiny. It doesn't have any wear on it. They don't get
Yeah.
any wear. Like the life of a bar is kind
Right.
of what eventually turns it into a dive bar. And
Yes.
these, they don't age. They just
That
have this sort of permanent shine.
that's fascinating because it's almost like it takes the authenticity out of it.
Yeah, and they're nice. Like, I mean, they smell nice. They
Yeah,
smell nicer
yeah.
than the smoke too.
Yeah.
But there is something like missing from it that where you're never quite comfortable. It's a, you know, it always feels a little bit like a place in an airport to me.
Right. The whole country's kind of turning into one big airport at some point, I guess.
Yes, and there's a lot of like new places popping up, like where I live here in Raleigh, and
Yeah.
that's kind of what I always think is like I go in and I'm like, it's really nice. It looks great. I don't want to knock it. But if you know, I could be in an airport sitting in here. It just has
Yeah.
that sort of like prefab, like it needs to be some sort of middle brow nice that isn't like threatening,
Right.
isn't too grimy. It needs to hit a certain note, and that's what they've achieved.
Yeah.
And yeah, it doesn't have like the, it doesn't have the lifelines in it, you know, the wrinkles.
North Carolina seems to be a state where a lot of like New Yorkers and Californians are flocking to. Is that the case? I mean, what do you see like an influx of population in the last 5, 10 years or so?
Yeah, my wife and I moved here 9 years ago about, and we were leaving New York. We lived up there at the time. She's from there, and we were done. We were ready to get out of the city. And the company I worked for at the time had an office here. And where we moved was, I won't say rural, but it was like, you know, it's removed a little bit from downtown. It was very wooded. There were a handful of neighborhoods. Everything around me raised. Neighborhoods are going up. Like for the last 8 years, they've just been building houses, building houses, building houses. And even in my short time here, like you see it on the roads, the traffic, every, you know, you turn a corner and there's two new developments popping up. There's a lot of people moving here. They're trying, they call it the Triangle area, right? Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill. There's a lot of universities and colleges. There's a lot of jobs. There's tech, there's pharma, and then lots of other jobs besides that. It's a good area. I like it. I recommend it. I think people from Raleigh hear me say that and be like, dude, don't encourage any more people. We
No, exactly.
don't need the press. Stop it.
Yeah, because I got friends there I'm dying to visit because I've never been to North Carolina. The most south I've been on the East Coast is Pennsylvania. That's as far as I've gotten when I go in and out of New York, and I need to go lower and lower. And my friend tells me
Well, the
she fu
accent definitely changes there, but it's not quite Southern.
the in North Carolina.
In Pennsylvania,
Oh, in
they definitely have
Pennsylvania.
their own accent.
Oh my God, dude, the Philly accent. The Philly I
Yeah.
the Philly accent is so cool. I like I'm a huge like and when I was in Boston too, it's like the Boston accent. Like when you see this, it's amazing. Like this, I just remember this beautiful woman at the airport was she opened her mouth and was talking, and I'm just like, I'm in Good Will Hunting. It was just like, I'm like, holy crap. She's not like the only time I've ever, like, and that wasn't just her, but it was like all around me. And I loved it though. It was like beautiful. And then when I was in Philly last year, and I was just like, wait, the women that would talk that had the Philly accent, for some reason, I'm so attracted to that accent. I guess other people are attracted to like women who speak French. I'm the guy that's attracted to like Philly and Boston. I'm just like, oh, you're so working class. I love it. You know, it's just, oh, don't
I love that the Philly
stop.
accent is your version of the French accent.
Yeah, totally.
I lived in Baltimore for a while, and Baltimore's accent is like the cousin of the Philly accent.
Oh yeah.
It's not quite the same, but there's something about the way they're doing the vowels that
Yeah.
is, it's in the family.
Yeah. It's
Like
so
that, they go.
cool. And I love that there's still that regionality of accents. I don't know if we're because I know we're I feel like we're all losing the tongue a bit
Yeah.
with our accents. I mean, there's even a San Francisco accent that it's so hard to explain, and the only way I know a San Francisco accent is when I hear it, and that's because it's like my grandfather's, my great grandfather's, everyone who lived in San Francisco had that accent from a very long time ago. And then you hear like you hear some kid that was like grew up in San Francisco, and you hear that like just slight shift in how they word things, and you're just like, whoa, I forgot we do have an accent. You're just like, wow.
I know the LA accent, but I don't know if I know the real LA accent or if I just know the Saturday Night Live skit from the Californians where they do the.
You know what's funny about that skit? When I came to LA, like I thought it was funny when I lived in San Francisco. When I came to LA, I still have those real conversations. How did you get here? Did
Oh,
you take
really?
the you took the 110? Oh wow.
Yeah.
Why did you take the 110? You should have taken the 230 over to the and you, like and then all of a sudden you're like, "Oh, wait a second.
You
I'm
can go
doing the
down La
SNL."
Cienega.
Yeah, you just go to wait. You can't do La Cienega at this hour. So much
Worked with
fun.
people from California, though, and I can't not hear it now. Like,
Yeah.
I'm very aware of it from that skit when I hear someone, I'm like, you're from California. And they're like, how can you tell? And I'm like, your accent. And someone will be like,
Wow.
California doesn't really have an accent. And I'm like, oh, no. There's an up and down cruise to the way you speak.
Interesting. Huh. I wonder if I talk like that and I just don't know it.
I don't hear it speaking to
Okay.
you. I don't hear
Yeah.
I don't hear the one in my head anyway.
Yeah. And maybe that's because of the San Francisco living and
San
then coming
Francisco.
down here. And I still feel like what do you call it? I'm in an inv como se dice, an invader in a city that's not mine. That I it's but it that's LA like rattles me in general. Anyway, but that's
That's
I'll.
weird, isn't it? How, like, I've lived here for 9 years. I was in New York for over 10 years. When people ask, like, where are you from? It still takes me a minute where I want to be like, I'm from Myrtle Beach. Like, I haven't lived there in a long time, but
Right.
everywhere else I live, I never quite feel confident being like, no, I'm from here.
Yeah.
Because I guess it's your birthplace, right? Like, you're locked into it.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess that's even like with astrology and stuff too. I used to be more into astrology, but like it's just like that birthplace like will forever be the birthplace. You can't change that.
Yeah,
It's
no, it's bred into you, and
yeah.
I feel a little bit like a traitor if I say I'm from somewhere else.
Yeah.
Like, I can't say I'm from Raleigh. I'm not from here. I'm from the beach. I mean, that's where I'm from. I can't
Right.
say I'm from New York,
Right.
even though I paid taxes for a decade. Like, I'm not really, can't say I'm from here.
what did your wife was born in New York City? She
She was born in Queens, and then they
Oh,
moved up
okay.
to like the Hudson Valley area when she was young, so
So
she
she
would
so
claim she is from,
from
yeah,
Queens.
she's from upstate.
Oh, she would claim
Yeah, I mean,
upstate.
that's what, yeah. I think she would probably, because they moved to Yonkers first, and then they moved up to it's near Poughkeepsie, like this little
Okay.
area, like Broadway Junction.
Yeah,
And I
yeah.
think she would claim Yonkers and the Poughkeepsie area are where she would say.
Yeah. Did you move to New York? Wait, we could start talking about writing if you like. You know what I'm saying?
No, yeah, we're back with that.
No, this is how we go. But when you were in New York, were you like fully in your writing career? Or did you kind of go up
Thought I
there with a
was.
writing idea and then I mean with a idea that you were a
Oh
writer
yeah,
and then
man.
yeah. Yeah.
I got out of college and I was fully under the belief that, like, I am going to write a book. I'm going to support myself,
Yes.
eventually a family. I'll just crank out novels.
Oh, the deceptive, the delusional lie that gets us here. Yes, my friend.
No, I blame my parents in a very positive way. I blame my parents who
Oh,
were just sort of like,
really?
yeah, no, you. Oh, well, I mean, they were very nice. They were like, yeah, if you want to be a writer, you should do that, man. You can be things.
Yeah.
So I love it. And it was also like, then it was like the early days of the internet. Like, we didn't have the, like, I think there was a little difference in publishing. I mean, I think like advances were bigger. I think you did, in fact, have a little bit more of a chance. I think it
Yeah.
was probably not as good of a chance as I thought it was, but I think the chance that did exist was larger. But I got up there. I got a job at a publishing company that did library school and library books. I started freelancing. I started picking up gigs. I got paid for some of them. I
Yeah.
started getting some stories published. And I don't know, a year or two, I quickly realized like this isn't going to be a job.
Yeah.
You know what was funny? I started getting gigs that paid, and I started like freelancing on the side when I wasn't at like my full-time job. And I just realized, I guess like maybe like it was doable, but I just was never, I wasn't in, I didn't really want to be writing the things that I was writing, you know, reviews and little pieces for like small press, like papers and stuff like that. I wanted to write my own things, and I very quickly realized like this money is just not, I'll be struggling the rest of my life. I'm not into that. It's probably, it broke the romantic artist in me pretty quickly, where I was sort of like, oh yeah, I like having health insurance.
Isn't it
I
great?
like being able to pay my rent. Yeah, no, it's rad. I like being able to go to the doctor and they're just like, no, that's covered. $20 for walking in the door, but the rest of it's on the insurance company.
Yeah, right. The second I hear like if a doctor's behind me and I hear a snap of a rubber glove, I'm like, oh wait, is that covered? Is prostate stuff
Yeah.
covered? I mean, no, I don't mind if you stick it
Have a
in there.
problem with it, but I
I
want to
just
make
want to
sure I'm not
know.
paying for it. Yeah, I want to know I'm not paying
Leave
out of
it in
pocket.
there if you like. I kind of hurt things, but you know, that's funny.
So I, you know, I started, I kept working full-time jobs, things that like had 401ks and stuff like that. I kept writing on the side, and I would get short stories published, and I always did it. I never stopped doing it, but I stopped believing that it was going to be like the way I made my living. And I think that's a reality for most writers. I think the writers who make their living off of writing fiction anyway, exclusively, is a pretty small percentage of like the writing population. I think most of us are working full-time gigs and you know, doing this on the side. But I kept at it for a while and I kept doing it. I would get something published every now and again. I'd get picked up by a magazine or something. I self-published a couple of novels and
Oh, okay. Was that so are those novels still self-published, or did you end up at a publisher
no,
with
they're still
those?
self-published.
Oh, that's cool.
And then a few
And
after
that's
I moved
back
to
in the
Raleigh.
day. I'm sorry to interrupt, but that's kind of probably went back in the day where it wasn't so Amazon pushed in your face, where it's just like I because I
No, I got on that
remember,
train early.
yeah, I remember putting out a book. I used to run this literary quote. I'm doing heavy quotes on the word literary magazine called Cherry Bleeds, and we had an
Oh,
anthology come
nice,
out,
man.
and so I had to do the print run and everything. That's back. That was like. That was so-called self-publishing, but I had to find the vendor that was going to do the print run. I didn't have any money, so I'm doing all the design myself, and it was nothing like the plug and play that it feels like today is.
Oh, it's incredible. You can have a book out in 24 hours if you feel like it. I mean, depending on how
It's
quickly you
so
can.
dumb. It's not great. It's not good for society. People need
No,
to
it's.
it it's people need to work hard on the indie press side and make it hurt to put it out, and then they might have a thought and go, wait a second, my writing might not be good. I just started 3 months ago. And you're like, I know.
I think it breaks a lot of hearts. I think there's people who like do it through Amazon. And I think because it's going through Amazon, you're like, well, someone's going to buy it. It'll be on Amazon. People will shop and come across it. And that isn't the reality. Like the promotional aspect and getting the word out there costs time and money if you're going to do it and have any kind of sales.
But that's so cool because
And
that's,
after I,
yeah, go ahead.
no, I was going to say, after I moved to Raleigh, because I used to still do the thing where I queried agents. I would send out the letters. And I don't know, man. One day I was writing, I don't know, I was on my spreadsheet keeping track of like the next agent I was going to send to. And just like, I'm not, I kind of think this is BS. I'm doubting the process here with the like sending the letter to the agent, and you've got to send it to, 300 before you get your first reaction and all that. Your first response. And someone was mentioned like the small presses. They were like, just look at like smaller presses usually don't like indie presses don't require an agent. So I turned my attention with this book, like I just stopped querying literary agents and I just started going to small presses. And it like immediately people started replying, which was a very good feeling. Like if
Yeah.
you write, you know, it's a little lonely. You feel like you're kind of shouting into a void sometimes. You hear
Oh,
nothing
yeah.
from most people, like it's
Yeah.
a non-response. You don't even get a form letter back.
No.
But the small presses started writing back, and people would turn it down, but they would send me a nice note and explain why, and it's not the right time, and now it's almost right, but we don't kind of do. So much more rewarding. And then Apprentice House, who put this one out, responded, and we're like, we'd love to.
That's so
If you're
cool.
in, we're in.
Yeah.
I like when I talk to like younger writers now, that's kind of my go-to is like you should look at small presses. You should think of like indie films and all those bands you go see locally who are putting out their own albums and setting up their own shows and using small labels. Like that was kind of my mindset when I got
Yeah.
pivoted was there's people who put out independent films this way, and I'm banging my head against a wall like with this monolith of like the big five publishing and a literary agent, and this is doable in a much kinder scale, I think.
Yeah. And then, and at the same time, you're probably getting replies for Dirty Myrtle because you put in the work on those earlier novels and you put in the time and you know, they put in the blood, sweat, and tears on your own stuff. That back when it wasn't easy, back when it wasn't a click AI
Yes.
thing. And so
I
it,
also matured into the realization of you really, I hated it when I was younger and people would be like, it's done in the editing. You have to edit and edit and edit. And as a young writer, you're like, I don't want to do that, man. It's a
Yeah, Jack
drag.
Kerouac did it in 6 weeks, and then and we're yeah, it's I mean that was nothing, right? That's always the big
I
story.
finally matured a little bit and I was
Yeah.
like, yeah, no, I should spend more time editing it. I should let it sit and breathe for a little while and come back to it with fresh eyes.
Yeah.
Makes a world of difference.
It's and it, the do you feel the urgency to get to the end of it is less important now, like as you, because this is your third novel. Is this your third or fourth novel?
This is my third one. First
Third.
one published by not me, but this is third.
Okay. Did you, as you're working on it, did you feel less of an urgency for the outcome and to just try to put
Yes.
more time into it? Yeah.
Yes, 100%. When I was writing it, I wasn't in a hurry to get anywhere. I didn't know exactly how I was going to end it. About halfway through, I kind of started seeing where it was going to like go and what an ending could be. And even that changed a couple times, you know, as I kept
Yeah.
going. But I got the shape of it about halfway through, kind of where I wanted everyone to like wind up, where I wanted them to converge. And then I don't know, maybe three-fourths of the way through it, like a really good natural ending kind of occurred to me. And at that point, I was able to start writing toward that goal.
Yeah.
Like, okay, now I know I need to get everybody here, here, and here. Because I don't know if you do you outline?
I don't outline. I'll outline after I get maybe half where I think I'm about at a midpoint. Then I'll be like, okay, now I
Okay,
got
I'm
to
a little,
start
okay.
tracking scenes. Yeah.
I'm like you.
Yeah.
I let it go for a while. Once I kind of have a handle on like which characters are going to stay in the book, which plot lines are going to stay in the book, which things are interesting to me in the story, I'll go back and I'll do an outline from like what I've already got and try to plot out a few things of like where I think they should go. And I'll kind of keep that up. I'll write up, do a little bit in the outline. I'll think it out and maybe plot a little bit. But I do like you do. I write a lot first and then try to kind of see my way to the next several chapters or whatever, and kind of outline it out. That was also really helpful. I used to never outline. I would just like go.
So you would go from front to back on the book
Yeah.
without even looking back.
No, it was exhausting. I mean, it was a bad way to go
Wow.
about
No, but what a fascinating way too, though. That's how we find our way through this stuff, is we go through our processes that don't work. And I don't know. Do you feel even now, do you feel like the process that you did for Dirty Myrtle, do you feel like that's going to be a good process for your next book, or have you started your next book?
I have, and I've already tweaked it a little bit. I'm not like, I handwrite a lot.
Oh, yes. Amen, brother.
And on Dirty Myrtle, I'd switched to typing pretty early and started typing it through, which I didn't. I'm not doing this time. I'm writing a lot more of it. I realized, like, I was talking to someone who was like, I just can't you type much faster than you can write? And yes, I can. And if I was taking dictation or copying something that I need to type up, that'd be great. But like, I have to make it up anyway. I'm not really in a rush, I realized. Like, I don't need to write it as fast as possible. I have to make everybody's names up and everything. I'm sitting there staring off into space for a lot of it.
Yeah.
It really isn't a lot. It does, I don't lose any time handwriting.
Yeah.
And I get a little bit better draft out of it because I handwrite it. I go through and I edit the handwritten, like, however many pages it is, a chapter, wherever I decide to do it. I'll go back and like I'll edit the handwritten. I'll type that up, and then kind of more edits will happen as I'm typing it,
Yeah.
and then I'll keep working off of those drafts, and I
Yeah.
do it that way. And it I get a cleaner draft. I get a better draft faster, like that, I think,
Oh,
than
okay.
if I were to just like write it on my laptop.
Yeah. I do the
Like,
same
I think I
thing.
would. Is that what you do?
I'm on yellow pads. I buy yellow pads in bulk, and for like even the first draft of a novel or first draft of a screenplay, it's always on a yellow pad. And I didn't know why. I thought I didn't know why I was doing that. And then I heard somewhere about how our brain processes differently when we're actually going from brain to handwriting. And when we slow it down, there's the synopsis that whatever we're working in that plasticity, I'm saying it wrong, but
It's pretty close.
that is that close? Okay, thanks.
Yeah, it's good enough for good enough for government work.
but it's just like, it does something. It does something, and I don't know what it is, but I think there's just something really to handwriting and really to, I really like never bringing my computer to a coffee shop. It's just like I either
Yeah.
got my yellow pad or I have the printed typed in note. I have the printed typed in work that I can redline. I don't ever want to be at a cafe with and you were in Southern California recently where you walk into a cafe and there's 50 screenwriters with
Yeah.
constipated faces looking like that. If they don't get to the bathroom quick, it's coming out. But they're just like writing the next big, oh, I'll make a million on this one. And that's the vibe I hate about being in Los Angeles. Oh, kills me, man. Kills
I
me.
guess I didn't think about that. You have a lot of screenwriters out there, don't you?
Oh, and I teach screenwriting and I've done screenplays and I'm the jerk that hates myself, right? But at least I keep it at home. At least I do it at home, I don't stick it out in public. That's just embarrassing. Put it back in. Put it back in. Do that in the
Because
privacy.
you can tell, and so like you can tell from that screen, the screenwriting software, when someone's in there, you can tell it's final
Oh.
draft.
Yeah. Oh yeah, And that, I mean,
I
I
believe that about the handwriting. I mean that I go a little slower. I craft my sentences a little better, even though when I'm writing that first draft, I'm not trying to put my foot all the way down on the gas. Like, I'm trying to get the idea out, but it comes out a little bit more usable than if I
Yeah.
were to type it up like the first time.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm a little more, maybe I'm a little more cautious about what I put down on the page. I think about it maybe a little bit longer than I do if I can type so fast.
Oh, interesting. Huh. Yeah, sometimes I need to type. What I do though is I carry a little small portable keyboard with me that I can do to my phone. So if I'm
Oh,
like, oh
really?
man, I have to do this scene, and then I'll just flip it out and I'll type into my notes. And I don't need to see a screen. I just put the phone like in my pocket or whatever and just type. And it's going to my phone, but I'm just
That's
like banging out the whatever scene I need to bang out really fast. Yeah.
wild. I guess I probably should have known something like that existed. I never even thought about that though. Like a small
Yeah.
portable like keyboard that just like is it Bluetooth into your phone?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man, no
They
9 million
rock,
wires.
dude. No,
Yeah.
they totally rock, and the battery like lasts forever. And you bring it on a plane. You're like, oh, wait a second. But I never ride on planes. What I do is I have Xanax, drink, and watch Seinfeld.
I've given up trying to write on planes. Like, occasionally something occurs to me, like I'll take notes if I think of something fun or something that I'm like, oh, something I saw in the airport, I should use that. But it's a, I don't know, man. It seems like a lost cause. I can't concentrate. The seat's too small. There's something about it that just doesn't work.
No,
I see people when I fly deep into like some kind of work that they're doing.
I don't know how they do it.
And it's incredible. I'm like, I look at them and I'm like, good for you. That's, I could never.
I just write
No,
help. I write help just in case I need help, and I turn it upside down. So then when I realize that I'm gonna need help and I don't have the words, then I have something to show somebody. I hate flying.
I don't care much for it myself. I'm like you. I now that like I have, television in my pocket more or less because of my phone,
Isn't it
I'm just
crazy?
watching.
Is it now? Let's go back to smoking sections on airplanes, dude. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. I would smoke on planes. And they had a smoking section, and like we talked, like in the airport, it's a made up division. Or I'm sorry, in the restaurant, it's a made up division. In a plane, it's barely imaginary. It's just the whole thing is now a smoking tube. If one person is smoking on this plane, we're all smoking.
But what I found out is the air filtration system in those days was so much more cleaner and so much more robust. They don't have to filter the air out anymore, so we're doing so much less that it's kind of like less pure now. Like the purifiers aren't as strong as they used to be, which I'm just,
See there, smokers were saving lives. Smokers were giving you better
smokers were
air in
saving lives. And it's and
in
I
some very, very niche circumstances.
I couldn't believe they took smoking off planes when they did, because I'm like, do you want angry people in the sky? Because like people who can't smoke for 6 hours are not going to be happy people. I
No,
don't
and
know how
people are
Sean
angry in
Penn does it.
disguise.
That guy smokes like 4 packs a day. He's got to have like 3 patches on and, lollipops or something. I don't know what he does.
I love that he's just still unabashed about it. He's just like, no, I smoke all the time. I'm not going places if I can't smoke. I'm not sitting at the Oscars and not smoking.
And it's to, and to be Sean Penn. For some odd reason he came up on my algorithm, because I have given my algorithm to everybody. And but he there was something of him just like the other day in LA where he was like just pushing people to get out of his way, because he was just as half the people were trying to get an autograph, the other half people were just standing in Los Angeles on the sidewalks of Los Angeles. And when they say Los Angeles is a city, they don't mean that people know how to walk. No Angelino knows how to walk in Los Angeles. It's like if you throw them in a you throw them on a sidewalk in New York and they would die in 2 seconds. And that's something that just I despise my anyway. But so Sean Penn walks through them. He just got a cigarette dangling out of his mouth and he goes right into the building. I'm just like, oh man. And
I
he's
love
gonna
to see
be,
it.
yeah, I gotta figure out what that was. I don't even know what it was. It was.
Another, hopefully another Thomas Pynchon adaptation. That seemed to do well for him.
Which one
With
was that? Oh,
one battle
I
after
still need to
another.
see that. I didn't know that was a Pynchon book.
Yeah, it's a loose adaptation of Vinland. It's solid.
I've tried to read him and I can't. I don't get into it.
I don't you it's a very it's Buddy, I need. Sorry, buddy, I need you to go. Okay, man,
Hey,
come
buddy,
here. Sorry.
please. That's fine.
It's very exciting. Just got back from swimming lessons.
Oh, cool. You're like, kid, I
Thomas
got
Penn.
my it's
Thomas Pynchon.
publication day. Okay, can you just give me
It
one
is
key?
publication.
Go ahead.
Thomas Pynchon's a little bit like pineapple on pizza. Like it's a taste you like or you don't, I think.
I
There's a
love.
little bit of work that goes into it, and you enjoy doing that work or you don't. It's not quite the casual enjoyment of reading that, you pick up a, I don't know, some other kind of novel. Dirty Myrtle that you pick up, and it's a little bit of a easier entry into enjoyment.
There was another author that I recently read that was not an easy read. His name was Steve Erickson. And the book was called, what was it called? State something station. And I was like, this is hard. Characters are kind of all over the place, but the voice is so good. I'm in. I'm totally in. And maybe he's got a little pinching type thing where he like his rhythm like matched resonated with me, whereas like Pinchin probably it's we're just off, or I'm off.
I think there's
I'm
authors
always
like
the
that.
problem. What's that?
No, I think there's authors like that. There's, I read a, I've only ever seen this name written down. I've never said it out loud before, but I think it's China Meville. And I read a couple novels by him, and they're not easy, but like what you just said, there's a rhythm to them and a voice to them, and this little bit of surprise at the way the sentences are structured. That's really, really enjoyable when you read one and like realize it's kind of out of the order that you would think. It's a nice surprise, and it's worth how long you have to chew it.
And then you got to get back to Dirty Myrtle and the other good books that are out there, so to go. Okay, now I'll just have some steak instead of getting like, gagged with like lobster roll or whatever that was.
No, if I read someone like that, I have to do a palate cleanser after, like something, something that goes down a little easier.
I just started getting into is it the Parker novels, the author's Richard
Yes,
Stark.
something like that.
Oh my God, I'm reading that, I'm going, because I have a hard time finding good like hard-boiled crime writers that I really get into, but like there's that one, I'm just like, whoa, okay, I'm in on the Parker series. So
There was a movie recently, a Parker movie.
with Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah.
Yeah,
And
it
Lakeith
was,
Stanfield was in it.
who was?
Wahlberg and Lakeith Stanfield were the two.
He was in Sorry to Bother You, right? And on
Yeah.
Atlanta. Dude, he is so good, especially in
Yeah.
Sorry to Bother You. I was like, my mind was, yeah. And he was great in the Parker movie too. It was so perfect. It's
I
just,
loved it.
yeah, did you, yeah.
No, I
I
loved it. It was a fun ride. I recommended it to everybody. It was a movie that kind of I saw no promotion for it. I actually heard someone on a podcast talking about how they had adapted a Parker novel, and I was like, "How did that get by me?" And then I looked it up, and there were a ton of big actors in it. And I don't know, I didn't see any like previews or anything for it. I never heard about it.
It's so strange when something like that gets kind of
It had been
dumped.
out for like 3 years by the time I saw it.
It's such a trip. With Dirty Myrtle, were you exploring Myrtle Beach and where you grew up for the first time, or was this also in your previous two novels? Was the setting there in the other novels as well?
No, it's the first time. And that book started as like a literary fiction, like a family drama. And I had characters, and I had maybe five chapters. And I don't know. You ever when you're writing something, like you hit a point where you're like, this isn't really interesting even to me. Like I like the characters a lot. I like some of the dialogue a lot, but like all of the action was like interpersonal kind of things. And I was like, I don't know if I would read this, and I certainly don't want to keep writing it. And I put it aside, and I was feeling bummed about it. And I watched randomly. I rewatched Blood Simple, the Coen brothers' first movie. It was on some streaming service that I have, and I was like, "Oh, I haven't been a minute since I saw that." And I watched that, and I was. It got me thinking about genre, where I was like, "This is." It got me thinking about genre as like this container where you can put another kind of story that you still want to tell, but the genre walls around it give you an excuse to kind of beat up some action that keeps the book moving in a little bit different way than literary fiction sometimes does. So I started playing around. I kept like some of the core things like very much the same, and I started playing around with like I just picked the kind of the simplest. I was like, what is a crime that I could reasonably write about? Like, I don't know a lot about counterfeiting, for example, or the drug trade. Like, I wasn't sure I could reasonably write about that. But I was like, kidnapping is kidnapping. Like that, I feel like I can write about that. So this family that I have, what if I just take this and this character, she gets kidnapped, and that that kind of opened it up. I started having a lot of fun with it. I got a couple of chapters down. I went back and rewrote those once I played with the conventions a little bit and like started kind of thinking through the characters and the action. I went back and started it over again. And that just really worked. I was just that was a way to give a story some shape that once it got going, it could kind of go on its own. Like
Yeah.
once she gets kidnapped, someone has to go get her, right? Like
Yeah.
that's it's kind of baked into the premise. There are several things that are kind of baked into genre that you can rely on. And if you build your characters and some of this other stuff that I wanted to put in there around it, it really just kind of helped move it forward. And it turned out it was a lot more fun for me to write than the one I'd started. Like the story
Yeah.
that I had in my head, it was a lot more fun to kind of ramp it up. And I had a blast putting it together. Like I hadn't done that before. I had always kind of had just I wrote liter I like reading literary fiction. I still
Yeah.
like it.
Yeah.
And I like genre fiction, but I just never played with it before. And this was the first time. I was like, oh, it's a really liberating thing to kind of have a box that you have to work within.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Guardrails are not bad. You know.
No, I think of the White Stripes sometimes when I think of this, where
Okay.
Jack Black's a great, or I'm sorry, Jack White,
Yeah.
the other Jack the color in his last name. Jack White's a great guitarist, but like he limited himself to like these two people. And the amount of I think that the box he put himself in with the White Stripes, so much good music came out of that. And then I heard him in the Rancontours, and they're a good band. I don't know, but they have access to too much. There was something
Yes.
about the limit. The
Yeah.
limits of the White Stripes that made them far more exciting for me than the Rancontours, which is a band I like. Jack White, if you're listening, calm down. I like the Rancontours, but the White Stripes.
We're always telling Jack Black to calm down, Jack White to calm down on this show. It's just that's a segment, so.
I don't want you to get a call. But no, the White Stripes are so explosive and so exciting, and I think it was because like you have to kind of think a little bit more creatively when you've got these walls around you. Like you said, guardrails
Yeah.
aren't bad.
No.
And putting it into this sort of genre piece, the guardrails were nice. I liked them. I like knowing that there's a limit to what I can do and having to kind of think through, like, all right, this is sort of how these things work. You know, you can't like take a left turn in the middle of it and make it a completely different kind of book. People are going to get
Right.
mad. It doesn't work well for narrative. And it was great. I'll probably do it again for the next one.
Yeah. And you hit on exactly how we have to approach writing, how I always say we have to approach writing. You had fun with it. Because people can tell, I
Yeah.
think people can tell when you read an author, if they didn't have fun with it, you can kind of vibe it and you just kind of don't like the book. But when you have fun with it, I think the reader picks it up and that fun energy comes through. There's something, it's just like it's like when I talk about like writing from anger. It's, a lot of my stuff that I start comes from something, it comes from anger, but it's something I get angry about. And then I get angry about it. So I start asking the question because I can't sustain 3 years on a book with anger. I got to sustain it with love and joy.
Yeah.
The idea is there out of anger. And then I'm like, okay, why am I silly for being angry about this? And then, and then make my character silly for being angry about it. And then it's then just go, yeah, that character's crazy. But no, I'm crazy. But it's just,
No, that's a very good point. That
yeah.
like in Dirty Myrtle, there were like things I wanted to say about real estate and money and how money moves. And if I'm just putting that on the page, it's going to sound like a knockoff Dennis Leary rant from 1991. Like it's just,
Yeah.
that's kind of how it's going to come out.
Yeah.
But when it's something where there's a character who works at a bank and where it's happening inside the plot, I can put, yes, I can make fun of my own anger about it. I can draw out some of the things that I see as injustices about it or ironies or, I don't know, evilness, whatever it happens to be. I can pull it out in a way that takes some of my screeching voice away
Yeah.
from what it is I'm trying to put together. And it is more fun for me to not be dwelling in my own anger while I try to write it. It's more fun to do it this way. And it
Yeah.
frees me up to, I think, probably say some things about it that are maybe a little more clever than I would have come out with if it was just, a screed.
Right. Oh, totally. No, that's the sweet spot. That's the hard sweet spot to get. And I feel and I it's and, you know, it's it, when you pick up a book and you're just like, oh, you just feel a little repelled, and it's probably because the author's a little repelling. You know, it's
Yeah.
just like, and you and
Or
like
they're trying
all.
to tell me something a little too emphatically.
No, that's I preaching is just off limits for me. I just
Yeah.
it's gross. I grew up a preacher.
Yes,
I grew
that's
up a
it. It's
Jehovah's
preachy.
Witness preacher. So I was knocking on doors when I was a kid, all for a very long time, trying to get people, you know, join us because we're the only ones. And I'm just like, I'm done preaching. I've been done preaching for 20 years. So,
That's interesting. You grew up Jehovah's Witness?
yeah. I'm still in therapy for it too. It's fun.
I don't know if I've ever met a Jehovah's Witness not at my door.
Oh,
Like I
wow. Well, I got out. I mean, I'm gone.
Well, yes, okay, I'm sorry. But like you go out into the world and you bump into Methodists, I guess is what I mean.
Right.
I feel, and this might just be me making it up based on like who I talk to, but like I feel like the Jehovah's Witness keep to themselves.
Yes, and they don't. They kind of don't. I mean, this was me too. I didn't want to. I didn't like even after I mentally like left and realized that what it took. It was a huge long process, but I was very ashamed to even say I grew up a Jehovah's Witness, and it took me a while to be open about it and go, wait a second, it wasn't my fault. I can just say it, and it's just like. I when I it was funny because I used to be married, and my ex-wife is a makeup artist, and she would take me to her party sometimes, and then when at one party I met this gay couple, and I'm like, oh my God, I used to think you were gonna die at Armageddon. I was like, dude, and I was like coming out as this like guy who like did not like gay people for most of his life and knew that they were wrong, and I'm like, now I love you, now I get it, now, and I was just like. And then the next day, because she's a Jehovah's Witness, she stayed in and she's like, what did you talk about with those guys? And I'm like, oh, how I used to like not like them because they were gay, but now I'm not, but now I'm cool and I'm so excited and I can just tell people it's okay. But and then she's like, can you not do that because I'm still a Jehovah's Witness? I'm like, yeah, don't you understand? Like that thinking could be wrong. She didn't like that at all. So
Isn't it wild how, because I grew up Catholic
yeah.
and my parents were very tolerant, but like the Catholic Church, like this, it is just kind of back then and probably still, I haven't been in a very long time, much like you. I don't do that
Yeah,
anymore.
yeah.
But it was just the teaching that like these people are wrong, they're sinners. And you get this idea in your head that like they must be like something.
Yeah.
There must be something about them where you see the sinner
Yeah.
immediately. And then you go out in the world. And it was probably the first time I was bussing tables. Like you work in a restaurant, you're gonna bump into gay dudes.
Yeah.
Where I met a couple of gay guys, and I was like, "Oh, that guy's just drinking iced tea.
Yeah.
That guy's just helping himself to one of the rolls. They're just dudes."
Yeah, exactly. And looking back when I was doing restaurant work in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, the gay customers were the greatest customers. The minute I would see a gay couple, I'd be like, "Oh my God, please come to my table." 'Cause I just knew there was going to
Oh,
be
yeah.
zero problems. It was going to be great. It's just like anyway. Yeah. That's the note we should end on. The book is called Dirty Myrtle. His name is Kennedy Weibel. Kennedy, thanks for coming on the show.
Tony, thank you so much for having me. This was fantastic. I loved this.
Yeah, I did too. All
It was
right.
great. Yeah, it's a great show. Thank you for having me.
This is for you guys. It's called Carnage. Always seem to be saying goodbye, rolling through the mountains like a train. My uncle's at the chopping block, turning chickens into fountains. I'm a barefoot child watching in the rain. That stepped into this song, taking a bow and a step right out. reading Flannery O'Connor with a pencil and a plan. This song is like a rain cloud that keeps circling overhead. Here it comes around again. And it's only love with a little bit of rain. And I hope to see you again. A reindeer frozen in the headlights steps back into the woods. Look over there, the sun, a barefoot child with fire in his hair. Then a sudden sun explodes.